Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me, as always, my two cohorts. There's Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. This episode will be getting out to you a little later than usual because we had some scheduling errors this weekend. But, you know what? Deal with it. I'm genuinely apologetic, but I have no excuses and nothing to offer you, so I hope you're okay with it. The good news is that this movie that we'll be talking about today is not something that like hit and was a wide release and everyone's going to be talking about. It's kind of a slow burner, a slow roller. Maybe you've never seen it. Maybe you've never even heard of it. But it is Escape from Tomorrow, the film that was shot in secret in Disney World and Disneyland by writer-director Randy Moore. And a couple of no-name actors. They went in there, they shot it guerrilla style, and this is what they got. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to see if it's worth the trouble they went to, if it's a interesting curiosity from a filmmaking standpoint, or if it actually is a decent film. Who knows? We'll tell you. Before we do that, I'd like to say that you should leave us a comment on iTunes. Thank you very much to everyone who's given us a rating. And you can always talk to us via the comment sections for these podcast posts on thefilmstage.com, or you can send us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Usually we open up with a discussion topic. Unfortunately, we couldn't really think of anything to go along with this film. You know, it doesn't really embrace any broad themes that we thought we could delve into. And as far as movie news goes, not a lot going on. So we figured we'd make it a short episode, which is good because it came out late, so we know we're already cramping your schedule. And we'll just talk about Escape from Tomorrow, and then a rundown of the things that came out in DVD and will be coming out in theaters this coming week. Give you a random suggestion of something we watched on our own, and then we'll be on our way until next week when we'll be talking about The Counselor. So all that backstory filled in, let's talk about Escape from Tomorrow.
People come here because they want to feel safe. Bad things happen everywhere. Be happy all the time.
Something's wrong with Elliot.
There's something going on here. It's this place!
So Escape from Tomorrow is the movie that's basically better known for how it was made than what it's actually about. This movie was shot secretly in Disney World and Disneyland and a little bit on green screen. We'll talk about that. The actors had the scripts on their iPhones, and the director and cameraman were basically like very far away from them when they were filming to make it appear as though they were not actually shooting a movie. Interesting. It gets pulled off. They made the film. And there was a question whether or not we'd ever actually get to see this film because the assumption was that Disney would just lawsuit them into oblivion because of the way the park is portrayed. But what do you know? Came out, got a theatrical release. It's in limited release now. And it is the story of a man on vacation with his wife and two children, and the way that he very slowly begins to suffer a psychological break from reality while visiting the park. Or does he? Time will tell. Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off? What were you expecting from this film, and did it deliver, and do you recommend it?
Well, it is important for a film reviewer to be honest. Wouldn't you say so?
I would think so. But, you know, we got some quote whores out there who just want to get their name on a poster. But we're not that special yet. So
no, nobody's
putting
us.
We have to be honest.
When the quote offers start coming in, though, it is quickly going to transform.
We're not there yet. I will flip and sell out as fast as I can.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that up front.
So I must admit that there were some biases, perhaps against the movie going in, because several people I know, most of whom I trust, had seen this at Sundance, and the reaction was mostly negative, which is not to say terrible, which is not to say predominantly negative, just there was ambivalence about it. Sort of the expression that while it had a fascinating concept and the story of its creation was something that could almost facilitate a feature of its own, it perhaps did not live up to said concept and said story of production. So going into it, my expectations were a bit low, but I was curious, certainly. Shot secretly inside Disney World. Okay, well, I haven't seen a film that's done that before, so we're off to a start. I mean, I guess no matter what, you're always off to a start, whether it's good or bad. We're off to a good start.
There we go.
So as the film begins, I'm intrigued. You know, it looks surprisingly professional. It looks surprisingly like an actual film. It doesn't seem like someone's travel log, and the black and white photography, while not necessary at all, does look relatively nice. And I am a fan of contemporary black and white photography, so long as it's done well. And I would say this is done well. So look at that. We've already got something going.
All right.
But. As it goes along, further and further, as narratives develop and character trajectories take off, I can recognize places where this movie is not precisely working, and where it felt as if they were really constrained and they couldn't quite exert themselves as much because of the conditions under which this was created. But, okay, there are still things going on here. There's still something to appreciate. But then there was something like an hour and 10 minutes left in the film. And the further we get into it, the more these issues begin to weigh on the movie. And eventually, the film buckles out from under it. And then there's still something like half an hour left. And I pause the Vimeo screener, and I say to myself, wondering, how much longer do I have to watch this piece of shit? And at that moment, the main character is kidnapped or something, and he's put into this device that's another corporate criticism,
really,
which
random corporate
is completely
criticism.
Unmotivated and makes no sense and has no bearing on the actual film. And those final 30 minutes really soured me, and the final twist of the narrative made me flat out hate this movie. I hated Escape from Tomorrow, and I think it's a terrible film, but I actually dislike it even more than I normally should, and as much as you guys should, really, I think so, because we would not be talking about this movie if it had not been shot secretly inside Disney World, because there is very little else that is worth discussing about it. What's worse is that it does so little with that itself. It's the most redundant, expected, fish-in-a-barrel, low-hanging-fruit criticisms that do not contribute to the movie at all. They do not embolden it in any significant way. And by the time we reach the end, and it's just this ridiculous, over-the-top, completely unbelievable, I don't even know what you would call it. Is it even a criticism by that point? Because it's been hammered in so significantly that it has no weight anymore. And, you know, the conclusion of it, the problem is that this film thinks it is so clever. It thinks it is so funny, and it's so biting. It's really grabbing the man by the balls, isn't it? But it does nothing. I wish Disney had suppressed this movie. I really do wish that Disney had stopped this movie from coming out. This is what this movie has done for me. I am rooting for the big guy. That's what Escape from Tomorrow has done. And in that sense, it has completely failed its objective. Fuck this movie.
All right. Danny King.
Wow. Yeah, follow what do you up. Want? What do you? Oh, follow up?
Yeah. Did you ask what I wanted?
Yeah, no.
What are we here for, Dan?
I was still, you know, reeling from Nick. Yeah, okay. That was shocking.
Now that he's hit that one out of the park, why don't you step up to the plate? What were you expecting from this film, and what did you get?
I mean, in terms of, like, my conception of it from Sundance, I really didn't read much about it. I had heard that it was shot at Disney, and for that reason, it might not get released. And I think I heard that, and I was like, all right, I don't really need to worry about it. And then when I, you know, figured out we were going to be talking about it for this podcast, I sort of looked up what the premise was. And I actually sort of got like an okay vibe from the premise, just because I can get behind this idea, not only of sort of illegally making a movie in Disney World, but filming a sort of really odd domestic quarrel within that space. Just conceptually, that seems like a promising avenue to take. But the specifics of where writer-director Randy Moore chooses to sort of explore and where he goes with his film is really just unpleasant. And, you know, as Nick's tone sort of implied, it's kind of annoying by the end. In the beginning, it's sort of, I mean, like, the basic, like, inciting incident of the plot, I guess, is that this dad gets fired, and he doesn't tell his family about it. And then he starts, like, chasing after two, like, really young teenage French girls for, like, a half hour. And it was just really unpleasant to watch those scenes, because it's just like this guy like leering after these young women for no real reason. We don't know why we're watching it. And then as the film goes on and on, it becomes more surreal. And, you know, the last half hour goes off the rails. And if there's one thing that's like really annoying to me, it's like bad surrealism. Because you can even watch like a David Lynch film, which is like obviously like a peak form of surrealism, and still be annoyed by the experience in a way, or at least frustrated by it. But when you're encountered with like really low grade surrealism, the experience can be really annoying, and you get to the point where you are like, oh my God, there's like 45 minutes left of this movie. So that is kind of where I ended up, I guess, about the halfway mark. I was kind of waiting for it to end. And yeah, I mean, I guess I like some of the details at the beginning. I think my favorite joke in the movie is like the simplest joke imaginable, with the dad and his kid waiting in line for this ride for like an hour. And then the ride like shuts down, and the dad's just like, what the fuck? Like in front of the kid. And I'm like, yeah, okay, like, that's a very relatable joke. Like, ha. And then he, like, starts following these, like, women around with the kid, like, right next to him. And it's just really unpleasant to watch and not very rewarding in any way. So I would say I came down quite negative on this work of cinema.
Would you say as negative or nearly as negative as Nick?
I think there were maybe times when I felt that negative. But at a certain point, I was almost like too bored to really like care that much.
Yes, this film is very boring.
Yeah, I think I just sort of, once like Nick said, once like that sort of shift comes about 60 minutes into the movie, I think I almost just like turned my brain off because it was so annoying.
So, okay, I was going to make a joke where I tried to put on the pretense that I loved this film. just to fuck with you guys, but I can't.
That would have been fun.
After hearing what you two have said, I mean, like, I was trying to think of, like, all the good things I could say about it, but I know that none of them would come off as genuine, so I'll just come out and say it. I was very unhappy with this film. Very disappointed. I mean, here's the thing. When I first heard about it, it was coming out of Sundance, and what I'd heard was a man, you know, at Disney World kind of like exposing or exploring kind of the faux happiness of the happiest place on earth and juxtaposing it with like his dissolving marriage and his midlife crisis and whatever. And I was like, you know what? I can get into that. I have been to Disney World. Which one is in Florida? Someone help me out.
I think... Yeah, World.
Disney World. Okay. I was at Disney World once. I forget how old I was. I presume I was in high school. And, I mean, I was, you know, I had my own personal things going on. I was going through some stuff. And you know what? It's funny because I was in line and I was in high school again, an age-appropriate girl who I thought was cute. And we were kind of flirting. And then we were going to sit together on a ride, but then some like bullshit happened where they had to like redistribute the line. And so I didn't get to be with her. And so I had that like thing where like you're spending the rest of your day like hoping to run into someone again.
Mm.
And so like the concept of that intrigued me because it's like this whole place is engineered to be a happy place. There are good things going on all over the place. Everyone smiles. Even the things that are supposed to be, like, terrifying and thrilling are done so in a way that it heightens the excitement rather than the mortal terror. So I was like, you know what? I can get into this. I've been there. I understand the duality at play between environment and internal life, and, like, how the attempt to make everything happy when you're not happy could, like, crush you and destroy you just because you feel so out of place. Anyone who's ever struggled with really crippling depression could also understand that. It could fill in for almost anything, but it just helps because it's a controlled environment where everything's happy. So I was, like, kind of amped for this movie. And holy God, does it just not work on any level. I mean, just, I could almost tell from the first few moments that it wasn't going to be what I wanted it to be. Once the dialogue begins, once you're introduced to the dynamic of this married couple, and we were just talking about this before we started recording, about how we caught some flack for the way we talked about Jasmine in Blue Jasmine. But the great thing about this movie is that I don't just have to say, like, the wife was, like, a shrew or a harpy, because the guy is an asshole and a pig. It's just a movie filled with bad people. None of them deserve anything good. This movie is misanthropic and nihilistic towards every sex, every age, every weight class. Like, it's just, like, you don't get a picture of happy people whose lives are being rent asunder.
This is what the bark does to you.
And because, like, if you think about it, like, if they had started off happy, you would have some stakes and you would watch them degrade and you'd get a feeling of, like, loss or sadness or something, some narrative motion, and you would give them something to fight for. But honestly, they just seem like shit people. It's one of those things where you're like, if I were to meet them, I would assume that, like, he got her pregnant and they were forced to marry and they just don't have the economic stability to divorce. Like, I can't imagine happiness ever being a factor in their lives. It's and it's bad when you start off that way, because then it's not Disney World's fault. It's not their children's fault. It's just that they're cold, dead-hearted, soul-shriveled monsters who will never be happy anywhere. And so his not even slow mounting madness, he's crazy as a loon by about 10 minutes into the film. And it's just like, from there, it's just like, okay, well, I guess I gotta watch this parade of nonsense for another hour and 20 minutes. And the parade is loud, but it's also halting, and it's, oh God, yeah, not a fan. I mean, there's just, and then you just start to notice all the little things, and I don't know if it was, like, the direction or the acting, like, maybe there was just something about the remove that the director had to have from the actors, that he couldn't give them correct coaching, or if he just, you know, was working on such a restrained budget, because he had to spend all the money getting tickets to the park, that he couldn't afford better actors, especially in the leads. But it's just like, there's some, like, deep-seated unpleasantness and madness here that sometimes felt like just poor choices of either direction or acting. And so, I get, like, 40 minutes in, there's really nothing to hold on to anymore, and the novelty has worn off, because you realize that they had this drive and this motion, they had this momentum to do something, and then just kind of decided that that was enough.
I will say, just so this is not entirely negative, that I actually quite liked the two adults' performances here.
No way.
No, really, I did. Because, yes, they are terrible people, and I think they communicate that very well, and I think there's something very authentic to, as someone who spent an unfortunate amount of time around piece of shit people like that, let me say that they get it right, that this really is how a lot of Americans are in the 21st century, in the second decade of this wonderful century we have. And there's something very, very unnervingly accurate about it. And so that was something I could appreciate. I thought the lead actor was actually quite good. I just don't believe that anything he's given is suitable. And yet, I think he makes it work, because Lord knows he doesn't. But I think that he sells what he is given. If this film did not have an enjoyable lead presence, I might have stopped watching it. But I did enjoy his work, at least. So, and pretty much every other actor in this movie is very bad, but the two parents are very good.
Yeah, so. I don't know if I agree at all with what you just said, but I'll take your word for it. God. Danny, did you think the acting was
in any way? Wow.
I mean, I'm not asking you to pick sides here. I'm just asking your opinion.
I'd say I was probably in the middle. I actually read a lot of reviews that sort of called out the acting as like very bad, and I definitely wouldn't go that far. I don't feel like the acting of the two leads ever took me out of the movie. I think there were other things that were like more the fault of the film. But honestly, like the wife character, like she just sort of disappeared for me after a while. And then, like, I don't even... What was, like, her last scene?
I mean...
I don't even remember.
Did they leave together or something?
No.
No? No.
We're respecting spoilers on this, so let's save her last scene.
All right, yeah. But basically, the idea is, like, I just kind of forget, like, what...
Her just... She, like, her every other... 80% of her lines were just, Jim!
Yeah, just, like, blurs together.
And, like, 90% of his lines were like, oh, over here.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
There were like a few weird craft elements to the film. Like for one thing, the score was composed by I'll probably mispronounce the name. Composed by Abel Korzeniowski, who did the score for A Single Man, and it's sort of unexpected that he would work on this movie. And he doesn't really change up his approach. Like he created a very loud, majestic, like studio movie score, which sort of feels really odd.
Yeah. Wait, can we explore Nick?
Yeah, go ahead.
The score here is good, I suppose, but in the context of the film, it's unbearable because it is so didactic. The intent that it's serving, it is just forcing the sensation upon you, and it's unbearable. I couldn't stand the fucking score to this movie.
It's crazy that it's the guy from A Single Man, because I love every aspect of that movie, score included. Mm-hmm. I wanted to hurt myself listening to this movie.
Right. I'm looking at the movie's Wikipedia page right now because I'm just bored talking about this movie. It says it has been compared to the work of Roman Polanski and David Lynch. And I must say,
black and white surrealism.
If this is our modern Polanski and Lynch, I am going to start blogging about politics tomorrow.
Oh, God.
That is my promise. If I would rather write about Ted Cruz and John Boehner than this movie, honestly. Yeah. I can tolerate that more.
I don't want to be... I'll put something out there. Like, this guy, he wrote this movie, he went out and he made it. You know? He did that. He's done more in the medium of film than I have. And that's great. Like, he should be congratulated, I guess, for making a film and seeing it through to completion, especially one this ambitious. But I mean, like, you know, we have people like Shane Carruth. And just, you know, just like that. There were times in this movie where I was like, what is happening? Why is this so bad? And then I would try to, like, you adjust your expectations, like, a little bit. You know, you're like, well, they're working like this, and he had to do this. And I'm like, but you know what? Shane Carruth went out there, and he's made, like, two instant classics. Because I feel like sometimes you just have it, and I just, like, I can't see this man making another film. There's, like, nothing in this film that felt... Mm-hmm. Like it was a through line of artistic impulse, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like he had an idea. He wanted to see if he could make it work, and he made it go to the end, and he resulted a film out of his actions, and that's, you know, so that's mm-hmm. good. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to belittle the achievements of someone who went out and really put themselves to something and did it, but at the same time, like, you know, it just...
You know what's strange? Right now I'm looking at some reviews this week that came out of Sundance, and it almost makes me want to watch the film again.
Wow.
Because the movie they describe is so good.
Give us an example.
Okay, so on the Wikipedia page, there's an excerpt of review from Drew McWeeny at HitFix. It's a very engaging piece of writing. It really makes me want to see this movie that he's describing. Would you like me to read it?
I would love to.
Text here. It is not possible that this film exists. It is not possible that they shot long scripted sequences on the actual rides. It is not possible that I just saw a film in which it is suggested and then shown that the various Disney princesses all work as high-priced hookers who sell their wares to wealthy Asian businessmen. It simply cannot be true. That sounds like a really interesting movie, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Guys? Doesn't that sound like a really fascinating, funny, exciting movie?
It does.
I gotta say. yeah, I really do want to see what's going on here. What do you think? Right? I don't know. It sounds good.
But see, that's the thing. I led in with, there are aspects of this film that I think would make an interesting, compelling movie. And they could have been done without all the other surrealist nonsense that really just decimates whatever deeper human story could have been told.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is, I can think of a few movies this year or this, I can think of a few movies in recent years that have, so significantly squandered their potential and everything entailing their creation. It's a real shame. I want to like every film, but especially a film like this, which went to these ends, and look what we got. It's just it's an ugly, soulless, redundant. It's terrible.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have to agree. It sucks because, like you said, it has. There's so much that you want to work, and yet. None of it does. And it's like the type of thing where it's like, I feel like now that this movie's been made, you're never going to get another movie like this, you know, that's in this setting that could use this world. And that's depressing. It really is.
There's also some bad green screen.
Yeah. We have an interview on the film stage where the director talks about the use of green screen.
What does he say?
At a point, he says that, you know, they had these shots that they did at the actual park, but, you know, for one reason or another, they weren't working. So they decided they had to green screen it. And apparently he had shopped out the effects work to a Korean company. And he was trying to explain to them that he wanted, if it had to be green screen, he wanted it to be, like, bad green screen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really bad green screen, just so it added to the surrealism rather than seeming like just poor reality.
Yeah, like that's how it felt a little bit.
Yeah, but I think, like, you know, he had it at like a 10 and it needed to be at an 11. But I don't think he could really get them, because, you know, these are people who are like, well, this is my work. I don't want to do my work purposefully poorly.
Mm.
So it was just, you know, I guess he didn't lean on them enough to make it look like shit.
I feel like the film could have actually benefited from a bit more of that, honestly. Because that was one of the, at that point, it was one of the few moments where I was really kind of engaged with anything going on because it looks so bad. But I love bad green screen. I really do love I love bad green screen. I think it's great.
Have you seen The Room?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
The Room
yeah.
is a masterwork.
I mean, I'm more talking about like surrealistic
green screen,
which I think, because this film is going for a surrealistic tone. I mean, it completely and totally fails at that. But that is a moment where it is achieved, albeit in an unintentional way. So even when this movie does fulfill its goals, it's doing it incorrectly. So good on you, Mr. Moore. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear indeed. Okay, well, let's pick this up and let's move into spoilers. Because, like, I think we can all agree that, you know, the movie could be an interesting misfire if not for maybe like the last 30 minutes. Is that
sure?
Right. I mean, I know we
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, let's talk about spoilers. So the movie, and this is another problem with the film, which is weird because it's a problem that's on a script level and not even, you know, an execution. There's a point where someone mentions something called cat flu. And then that apparently is what the main character dies of. And this is after he has had to help with the help of his daughter, escape from an evil witch, by destroying her amulet, after finding out that he or his father maybe had been decapitated, And he goes home and he's vomiting hairballs into the toilet and bleeding all over the place, and then his son just closes the bathroom door and lets his dad die.
Yeah.
And then we get Mickey Mouse gloved hazmat workers who come in and they zip up the body, and one of them touches the boy on the head and gives him a memory of going on the Buzz Lightyear ride that they had failed to get into earlier. And as the body is shipped out the back, a fresh family comes in, featuring a woman who I believe we only ever met on the screen at a ride. And the man, Jim, is back as her husband, though apparently a different version of him. And the cheerful Disney worker offers to help him with his luggage. Cut to black.
Scathing.
Scathing?
Scathing.
So, okay, let's engage with this film on its level. What do we think the ending is saying? Included.
Well, that's the thing, is that was there? I have to admit, I really stopped paying attention to this movie like halfway through because I was so fucking bored. But was something set up there? Or
there was a point when they were in the infirmary, and his daughter had just scraped her knee. And the nurse, the sexy nurse, that he's ogling. He is, like, the worst, like, philanderer. Or maybe the best, because he just gapes and stares at people like a madman. And she says something like, you know, oh, you know, everyone's worried about the cat flu outbreak. You know, you could be a carrier and not even know it. And then she starts crying when they leave. Which, for a second, I was like, oh, it's like Twin Peaks, but not good. And then he dies of cat flu. Big smile on his face, cat eyes, coughing up hairballs.
Weird.
So, what? Because here's the thing. As this was happening, I was like, this, not the cat flu so much, but parts of this could rescue this movie for me. Because what I assumed was happening was that they were just going to clean up the husband. And then there's a montage of the workers placing fresh stuff on the vanity, you know, like setting it up like the, like, you're just entering the room. And I thought what was going to happen after they touched that kid on the head and gave him that memory is that they were just going to send the family out as though they had never had a dad. And that would be part of the thing, like, that maybe they were thinking about the oppressively happy atmosphere. It's like, well, if someone dies here, we can't let people know that because it's not a happy place. So let's just get rid of him, give the kid a good memory of the thing that he wanted to do, and then send them out, and everything's going to be fine now. And as little as that would have worked in the movie,
that would at least be coherent.
Right. Yeah. But instead, we get nothing more with the family that had been there. We get him carted off, and then another him coming in with a different family. This is skipping over the entire moment where he was kidnapped, had Spaceship Earth constructed around his head, as Dr. Mengler Jr. talked about his imagination and his father, and Siemens was everywhere. And then we got a grotesque scene where he's squirting Neosporin everywhere, like semen.
Just a disgusting movie.
Anyway, let's focus on the ending. Do we understand what it's trying to say? Or can we see what we think it might be trying to say, but lacks any textual support for?
I mean, it's the classic. It's the classic, you know, you can check in, but you can never check out narrative.
It's kind of like The Shining.
Yeah, basically. Okay. You know, it consumes him, and he's stuck there forever. But who cares? Honestly, I just...
I mean, we're here to talk about the film, so I feel like we can't just say who cares. If
I'm just saying, rather I'm saying at that point, really, I didn't care. I mean, I understood it completely, but it wasn't, again, it was nothing that I had not seen before. It was nothing I had not seen done better. It was nothing that felt textually relevant to the movie at hand. And it also featured a character whose implementation into the plot is so slipshod and... is so quick that I honestly thought it's the scene where, you know, he's sleeping with the woman and whatnot. I honestly thought it was a dream sequence.
Right, me too.
Because the inclusion of it is so terrible that, I honestly thought maybe that's part of the movie's surrealism. I don't know.
No, because he's already crazy on the It's a Small World ride.
Yeah.
Which, again, like, right. There's no slipping. There's just he's crazy, and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And his son's a dick.
Yeah. I mean, the daughter seems like she's probably okay, I guess.
Yeah, she seemed nice.
She got hurt by that other kid.
Yeah, well, that kid was a jerk. Oh, God. Okay, well, that's how the movie ends. I don't know. There's really not a lot more to say about this. If in a year or two, Randy Moore were to come out with another film, would you watch it?
It depends what it is.
Yeah, it depends.
I've seen debuts that I hated, and then I actually like their follow up. I'm always willing to be surprised. I mean,
yeah.
When
I saw, just going back to, we can only go with what we know. So when I saw Primer or when I saw Hunger,
mm-hmm.
I immediately put those names in a ledger in my head and
oh,
said,
yeah,
I will
sure.
follow these men until the end of the earth.
Oh,
so
yeah,
Randy
yeah.
Moore is more on the questionable list.
Yeah, but the other thing that's like makes it difficult to predict where he might go from here is like all of his thinking, especially narratively, is due to this film being set in Disney. So it's like presumably if he makes another movie, it probably won't be set there.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be
probably not.
Probably got like posters of him around. Like, don't let this guy film anything.
He's not even allowed in the Best Buy anymore.
But I don't know. Maybe he'll be like a Disney World auteur, and that'll be his identity.
Perhaps. I'm doing a Google image search for Randy Moore. It appears there's a porn actress named Randy Moore.
Okay, that's probably not the same person.
Probably not. Oh, dear. This is graphic.
Not a great porn actress? Or like...
The images are very expressive. I clicked on the tab Randy Moore director. That brings me to it. I don't know. What is what he looks like tell me anything about him? Why did I think that? Anyway.
I don't know.
No, I'm going to say, like, he looks like actually probably, like, maybe he's, like, in his mid-30s or something. So he's probably got – I'm sure there are people who will want to work with him, who will want to see what else he's got cooking. I really have no idea what else he has up his sleeve. And maybe he's a hardcore cinephile and he wants to pay tribute to, Eisenstein or something. I don't know. Like, maybe he has really ambitious plans. And I don't know if he comes out, if he ever makes another film and I hear good things about it, I'll give the guy a second shot.
Okay. All right. Well, that's it for Escape from Tomorrow. It's currently on streaming platforms and in select theaters. We didn't like it, but I guess,
Did we give it a positive review at Sundance? Oh, I hope we didn't.
We could very easily look that up.
Let's look here.
Okay. Let's see if we've just gone against the official film stage line.
Yeah, well, we have to follow a line of command.
We do. We're completely coached on what we can say about these films. That's sarcasm for anyone who doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of disagreement on the show. Plenty of anger.
Yeah, lots of anger.
Rage.
Lots of edited out racial and ethnic slurs.
Yeah,
sexually explicit threats made against one another's persons.
Yeah, we give this a B.
Oh,
Raffy,
you son of a bitch!
He said it's dripping with style, and he compared it to Fellini. Oh my!
We're gonna have to shoot at that guy. Anyway, so that's the way it was. Let's talk about things that are coming out on Blu-ray and DVD October 22nd. So by the time you hear this, maybe already out. So listen close, because maybe you're going to want to buy some of this shit. First
that
up.
That was very aggressive.
The monster horror hit that doesn't actually involve monsters. So that was a poor... The Conjuring. Did any of us see The Conjuring?
Yeah, I saw it.
How was it, Danny?
It was good.
All right, excellent.
Yeah.
The Uninvited is coming to Criterion Blu-ray. Before Midnight, which I think we all loved, even
but
though,
also wait, hold on, the Vincent Price collection,
which is honestly
Vincent Price.
Does it say okay? It's The Fall of the House of the Usher, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Haunted Palace, The Mask of the Red Death, Witchfinder General, and The Abominable Dr. Phoebes.
So you've got your Halloween titles there.
Hell yeah. Also coming out, we have, as I was saying, Before Midnight, which we all liked. You can listen to our review of that. And The Internship, which I didn't see, but I heard nothing good about.
They're advertising an unrated edition of this, which is weird, because it's like a PG-13 comedy meant for... I don't know who it's meant
three
for.
Three fucks in there.
But Jordan actually saw the unrated version, and he said there's a scene where they...
where they Google Randy Moore.
Where they go to a strip club and there's like exposed breasts everywhere, and I guess like a guy like ejaculates on camera. Like a guy ejaculates on camera or something.
Like actually, like really, he does that shit?
I mean, I don't know if you actually see like expulsion, but he has an orgasm in the film or something.
Okay, I think
which
meant,
is
like,
crazy.
An extra like. You know, ran anyway. Also coming out, the documentary Leviathan. Did anyone see this?
Oh yeah, I've seen it twice.
Shit,
is that good?
Well, I mean, I really like it, but I saw it once at theaters and then once for a class.
I see.
Yeah, also, I can't wait.
I want to see it. Also coming out, I Give It a Year. No, moving on.
Whatever.
I've saved it for last. My I like this film. Only God Forgives. I will be purchasing that tomorrow.
I liked it enough, and I'm sure it'll look and sound wonderful on Blu-ray. I mean, it looked and sounded very nice in the theater. So
indeed,
you can get that. Kuntai mei na ikanta. So you can get some of that going on. Can I just mention a couple of things we might have skipped over?
Yeah, yes.
So this is a really small kind of, I don't want to say inconsequential movie, but kind of is. But I kind of liked it, The Way, Way Back.
Oh, okay, yeah.
With Steve Carell and Sam Rockwell and Toni Collette. And,
I heard good things
some
about
kids.
That from friends of mine.
It's. I saw it with a friend, and it was nice. I saw it on a Wednesday afternoon in the summer. And I was like, this is pleasant.
Is
directed by
he works at the water park.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's directed by Jim Rash and Nat Faxon, who are best known for writing in part The Descendants. And surprisingly, they actually feel like actual filmmakers, which was nice. I kind of expected something that looked like TV and felt like TV,
mm-hmm.
or rather, I mean, there are cinematic TV shows like Breaking Bad and Mad Men, but. I guess I was expecting something sort of sitcom-y, but it's actually a relatively well-directed film, which I wasn't expecting. There's some interesting things going on there with their camera shit. So there's that. It's nice. It's worth a rental. Maybe watch it one Sunday afternoon and whatever. And also, the Criterion is releasing John Cassavetes' 5 films on Blu-ray. Which
oh,
is
yeah.
Cool. So you got A Woman Under the Influence, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Shadows, Opening Night... And what is the
Faces?
That's correct. Yeah, there it is. I've seen 3 of those, and I really like the 3 that I've seen. So there you go. I'm sure those movies will look beautiful on Blu-ray. All the grain, all that Cassavetes grain, especially Killing of a Chinese Bookie, which is just submerged in blackness.
Excellent.
So yeah.
All right. So now that we're done talking about Blu-rays, let's talk about what's coming out into theaters. As we've already said, we'll be talking about The Counselor next week. Wide release, directed by Ridley Scott, who did Blade Runner. Let's go with that one. We also have Bad Grandpa, the newest from the Jackass people. We have
and Spike Jones, he's apparently... I've sort of learned that reading about her. He's like a Jackass person.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
He comes
so
from
I'm new to that. Like
culture type thing.
Yeah, I'm new to that information.
I've seen some of his old skate videos, and they're really good. Anyway, Blue is the Warmest Color is coming out in limited release. Hopefully, sooner or later, we'll be able to see that and talk about that on this podcast. I don't even know what the fuck the rest of these are. Oh, there's Bastards. Claire Denis.
Oh, yeah.
Bastards coming out. We talked about that last week. We also talked about Blue is the Warmest Color last week. If you didn't have a chance to listen to our New York Film Festival podcast, we were just talking about this before we began recording. A lot of times people be like, oh, it's from a film festival. There's not going to be anything in there. There are a lot of big releases that came out, and they get their premiere at film festivals, and we happened to talk about a few of them. We talked about Her. We talked about Walter Mitty. You know, we talked about Captain Phillips. Talked about 12 Years a Slave obliquely. We talked about Blue is the Warmest Color. So go there and check it out, because there might be some stuff in there that you didn't know we were talking about, and you might find some stuff that you didn't know was coming out that actually sounds interesting to you. So yeah, I'm going to say I can't wait to see The Counselor, Blue is the Warmest Color, and Bastards.
Yes, we're Brian and I, not together, sadly, but we're both seeing The Counselor tomorrow, so we'll have some idea soon. I said before we recorded, it's weird that it's this movie, directed by Ridley Scott, written by Cormac McCarthy, one of the greatest living writers, and starring Michael Fassbender, one of the greatest living actors, but there doesn't seem to be much hype around it. It seems to be kind of an under-the-radar release. And you have Brad Pitt as a cowboy, too. So I don't know. I'm a little worried because the review embargo isn't until like 7 p.m. on Thursday. So I am... I mean, I guess I would wonder, like, what goes wrong there, because the big problem with Ridley Scott is that he doesn't care about screenplays, like, at all. Yeah. He just wants to direct, which I kind of admire in a weird way.
but, I mean, the thing is, like, he...
But the thing is, it's written by Cormac McCarthy, so I'm thinking, like, how could it... What... You have someone who can really excel. Like, even like Prometheus, which is by no means a great script, is a very well-directed, very visually engaging film.
Absolutely.
Right? And, you know, I mean, not to rag on Damon Lindelof anymore, but he's not Cormac McCarthy. So what does the latter bring to it? I've heard the screenplay is very strange. Someone actually described it as the strangest parts of No Country for Old Men as a feature-length film.
Yes.
Which sounds so wonderful. I guess I'm just wondering if that's going to be something coherent or cohesive. From what I understand, the movie is probably going to be a lot stranger than the previews let on.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not going to be the crime thriller that you're expecting, which, hey, great.
Yeah, maybe that could be why they're kind of playing it close to the chest.
Possibly. I mean, I would like nothing more than for this to be an amazing... batshit mindfuck crime thriller that they're kind of trying to hide for those reasons, just because it's not what you'd expect. Hopefully it doesn't. Bastards is excellent, and Blue's the Warmest Color I'm looking forward to, despite all the hubbub and controversy. I think looking forward to that one. I'll get to see it soon.
Here. Danny, any thing to add before we move on to our random selections?
No.
Excellent. Random selections. Danny, why don't you kick us off? What's something you watched that you feel people at home should check out?
Oh, well, happy to start us off here. So I watched a sort of overlooked Clint Eastwood film from 1990 called White Hunter, Black Heart. And I feel like the movie has a lot of fans of those who have seen it, but it seems like sort of an underseen Clint Eastwood title, even though it's rather excellent. The movie is an adaptation of a book written by this guy, Peter Viertel, and it's based on his experiences working with John Huston trying to direct The African Queen. And Clint Eastwood is playing this pompous American director sort of based off of John Huston. So it's like one of the most stylized performances he's ever given, because he has this really unusual voice and like really macho body language. Well, he's always macho, but he's usually sort of stoic about it. And in this film, he's just sort of like a loose cannon. So it's
does
a
he
really
do a John Huston impersonation.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Does he like imitate his voice?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And like, there are moments where, I don't know, it looks like the voice, like the dubbing is a little off. Like, he really wanted to make like a weird fucking voice for the performance. And it like works. It's really powerful. And there are a few scenes that are like some of the best acting he's ever done. There's one where a woman makes like an anti-Semitic remark. And he goes on like a 4 or 5 minute rant at her. And the scene's on YouTube if you just like want to watch the scene. It's really good. And then right after he yells at her, someone else makes a racist comment and he gets in a fight with that guy, which is a pretty like amazing sequence. But yeah, so the film overall, it's like easy to see why it hasn't caught on, because it is very critical about like these images we have of like classical Hollywood directors. And the story is basically that he travels to Africa to shoot a movie, but all he wants to do is like hunt these elephants for strange personal reasons. So there's sort of like a second lead character who's always telling him like, yo, we should go shoot this movie. And Clint's like, yeah, but let's kill the elephants first.
Well, I mean, that's what I say almost every time I do.
Yeah, I that's why. Right, I was like, I agree with 12
years
Clint.
A slave? Like, yeah, but let's kill these elephants first.
Yeah, so I totally sympathize with him there.
No, I mean, that's a very common...
He's a very nice man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so disregard that and go in expecting a very strange, dark performance, and I think you will find the experience valuable.
Valuable?
Yeah, I think so. He's masterful.
Am I the only one who found something weird with the way that was pronounced?
How do you say it?
I don't know. He said valuable.
Huh.
I mean, like, that's how it's written. Like, that's valuable? Technically what it is. It's valuable.
Valuable, sorry.
Not valuable.
I have to say, I kind of...
That was my Houston impression.
So. Oh, okay.
I have to say, I kind of wish Danny had more of, like, a Chicago accent to him. But you don't.
All right, I've been told that I do sometimes.
No, you've been lied to.
You don't in the slightest.
Just, like, sort of a nondescript accent.
Yeah. Stoned, I would say.
My dad has said that before.
Yeah.
But Danny has never touched pot.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I just grow it.
But I wear gloves.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, Nick, why don't you give us yours?
I'm going to go with a motion picture that Danny has seen and actually wrote a very good article pertaining to this film and Before Midnight. So it's kind of tying together a bit. That is The Green Ray by Eric Romare. Yeah, I had never... the only Romare films I've seen are his Six Moral Tales and The Sign of Leo, which is his debut. Quite enamored with all of it. And I'd wanted to see The Green Ray for a while. Couldn't really find it. And then, lo and behold, I was in my school library, and it was just there, ready for me to view. So I grabbed it, and I did, in fact, view it. And I thought it was quite excellent. Yeah, I mean, I think this has actually been discussed before when Ethan was on. He talked about the movie. I think it makes sense because the movie leaves a very deep impression. The story of this woman who kind of is feeling sorry for herself and doesn't really know what to do, so she goes on a vacation, as you might. And, you know, it is very French, which might sound a little silly and reductive because it probably is a little silly and reductive, but, you know, it's this very loquacious, very philosophical, very elegantly paced piece of work about this woman trying to figure out the direction of her life. And Eric Romare, I feel like there are few people who make the act of speaking as cinematic as he can. It's not just that his dialogue is so engaging, but that he's just so adept a shooter and cutter of dialogue sequences. And I mean, there was actually a few moments that I rewound because I wanted to watch it again because it was so profound and so touching an exchange. So yeah, I was really, really quite taken with this movie. Unfortunately, it's kind of hard to find. I got a DVD from like Fox Lorber or something, a company that's not even around.
I was about to say, that's the only way you could see Last Year at Marienbad for a while was the Fox Lorber.
That's right, yeah. I had seen when I was in high school, I'd seen a few foreign classics through Fox Lorber. Anybody who's taken like a world cinema class has probably you've probably seen a Fox Lorber DVD with the shitty hard coded subtitles.
You don't like NFL.
Huh? Yeah, no, I mean, you know, they did make a lot of, again, like I said, they made a lot of great movies accessible. Unfortunately, they're not around anymore. The DVD is not. I imagine, I have a very hard time believing Criterion is not on this case, like, as we speak.
Yeah, you know they pick up the Fox Lorber scraps.
They often do, actually. So, yeah. So hopefully you can see it soon. I'm sure it'll pop up on Hulu Plus one day within the next few months. So, yeah, The Green Ray.
Nick willed it. Groundswell coming straight out of the film stage.
The Green Ray gets a gold star.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
I thought you were going to go with The Green Light.
No.
No. Okay. I'm going to talk about a film. This is a film that I saw randomly once when I was like 13, probably. And it was me and a bunch of friends hanging out, and the movie started, and all we saw was that Bill Murray was in it. And we're like, you know what? Why not? It's got Bill Murray in it. And we were like completely unsure of what the hell was going on in this movie. But it was funny as shit. And it came on the other day on a random channel, one of the premium channels. And I was like, you know what? I got to sit down and watch that again. Because I realized that I've told people about this movie and explained scenes from it more than I've actually seen it.
Moonrise Kingdom?
No.
Oh, damn it.
This is Quick Change.
I got nothing.
Nothing?
I thought you were referencing the Truffaut film. But that's actually Small Change.
Oh, I see. No.
Which is funny because Small Change was a... was a big influence on Moonrise Kingdom. So I was going to say, oh, how serendipitous that is.
And yeah, not so much.
Well, I'm looking up Quick Change right now.
Quick Change is...
Is this like Blank Check?
No, it's slightly better than Blank
Check. Is it a spiritual... Is it like... Is this sort of like the Three Colors trilogy? Like there's Quick Change, Blank Check, you know, Spare Dollar or something.
Spare Dollar.
Oh, it's Spare about Dollars. A bank robbery.
Yeah, it's a... So the setup of the movie is that Bill Murray... You're introduced to him in clown makeup and full costume with balloons on a subway train in New York. And he goes into a bank and he holds up the bank. And then, you know, the plot of the bank heist is revealed. And then the rest of the movie is him and his compatriots just trying to get out of New York. They just need to get to the airport, get on the plane, and fly away. And it's, you know, those nightmares you have or those dreams you have where it's like, oh no, I'm late for work. And then you realize that like your shower has turned into a meat locker and your car is broken. So you have to walk, but now it's raining like fire. And it's just like the weirdest things come up and get in your way. And the entire dream feels like this just massive hysterical panic because you just can't get where you need to go. That is what Quick Change is. As a humorous love letter to how much New York can suck sometimes. And as a fan of the city of New York, I have family there, I go up all the time. As a fan of Bill Murray's, as a fan of Gina Davis, I mean, like, it's a fucking hilarious, fantastic movie. I don't know if it's available. I mean, I'm sure it's available probably on DVD. You could probably pick it up for like $5. I can't imagine that it's going to be that hard to find. But I mean, it's just, there are scenes in this film that have stuck with me. Like I said, through that one time seeing it, God only knows how long ago, and were just as hilarious when I saw them again.
I've never even heard of it.
Sounds kind
of
cool, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just the kind of thing where like there's one scene where they go up to try to speak to a guy who is on a bike with a broom, his head bowed, and he like looks up and does the sign of the cross and then drives away. And the event that is spurred by this is one of the most insane, hilarious things that I've ever viewed on film.
Okay.
It's just that kind of movie. It's got a very weird, distinct sense of place, and it's got Bill Murray in it doing his Bill Murray thing. And yeah, it's good. It's the heist movie with the madcap comedy. So check it out. Quick Change.
I see Phil Hartman is in this.
Yes, he is.
Oh, is he? First of all, it is. You can get the DVD from Netflix.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I was going to say, apparently it's on Amazon Watch Instant.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So I was going to ask, I feel like this is redundant because it sort of answers itself, but is Phil Hartman good in this film?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I figured.
There's so many people who have small roles in this, and it's kind of incredible. Unfortunately, the cast layout on IMDb is by, appearance. So like the first 40 people are Hostage, but I mean, you get, Stanley Tucci is in there, I believe at some point, Tony Shalhoub, who else? The guy at the end, Kurtwood Smith, Red Foreman from That 70s Show, and anyone who doesn't know who he is. I mean, it's just like, there's just a lot of people and a lot of crazy situations, and the movie's relentless. So I say check out Quick Change. Little known movie that deserves a lot of fun and respect and laughs. So
this is the most anybody has ever discussed this movie in how long?
Groundswell.
Yeah.
Groundswell. It's gonna be on Criterion.
Yeah, so it's good. I remember I tweeted a question. If you could still have one of these comedians around, Phil Hartman or someone else, a very, very talented, very likable comedic presence who had died, who would you keep? And Eric D. Snyder replied to me and he said, the answer of who do you want to keep alive, Phil Hartman or any other person, the answer is always Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is actually kind of true.
Yeah, Phil Hartman's great. If you haven't seen News Radio, on that News Radio.
Or I mean his Simpsons appearances, which are just legendary.
I'm Lionel Hutz.
Troy McClure. Oh, dear. Miss that man.
Moment of silence for Phil Hartman, murdered by his wife.
Yes, sadly.
Yeah, that was a bleak day. He was great as President Clinton, too. Anyway, let's... Yeah. All right, Phil Hartman getting some love. That's it for today, so come back next week when we'll be talking about The Counselor, newest film by Ridley Scott, written by Cormac McCarthy, starring Michael Fassbender, Javier Bardem, Brad Pitt, fucking... Cameron Diaz, and I'm not looking at the cast list. I just want to remember this on my own. Damn it, Nick.
And Dean Norris.
And Penelope.
Which is weird because
Dean Norris.
It seems like this is taking a lot from Breaking Bad. Sort of the guy breaks bad. You know,
yeah, he's Breaking Bad.
And then it has Dean Norris and John Leguizamo's in it.
No, he is.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
doesn't everyone want to see this movie?
Because they've been bad.
All right. Well,
I'm actually looking up something really quick. Hold on. It'll make sense in a change. Second if it turns out to
quick change.
Be real.
If it turns out to be real. Let's just all chill out with Danny and his delusions for a second.
All right, never mind.
Okay.
Boy, how am I going to get those 9 seconds back?
Yeah, sorry. I thought I recognized someone in the Counselor trailer, so I looked it up to see if that was him, but it turned out to be a false alarm. So that's disappointing.
Okay, well, Danny, why don't you redeem yourself and tell us where you can be found on the internet?
Thefilmstage.com, certainly. Thekingbulletin.com and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com and Twitter.com/Newman.
And I can be found at my personal blog, DearFilm.net, as well as thefilmstage.com and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Join us next week. Oh, God. Oh, my God. That's getting edited out. We don't need to open up that way.